Good morning, everyone. We're reading in Book 11, the Book of Everlasting Day, and we've reached page 673, and I think we stopped at line 87 last week. That's about two-thirds down the page. There were some mysterious lines that we read last week. Arisen beneath a triple mystic heaven, the seven immortal earths were seen sublime. So I had no explanation to give about this triple mystic heaven and the seven immortal earths. So I wrote to a couple of people. Dr. Alok Pandey replied. I'll read you his reply. The triple mystic heaven is the threefold words of truth, consciousness, and bliss, known as Sat Loka, Tapo Loka, or Chidgana Loka. That's two names for the same world, and Ananda Loka. These are the three highest worlds of the triune Satchitananda. The seven immortal earths refer to the earth principle that exists on all the seven planes of existence, from the subtle physical to the world of truth. Our earth is a final condensation of these planes as they descend and crystallize for the sake of the play. Sat Loka, we could say, of course it's Sat Satya, but Sat is also existence. And Tapo is force, Chit is consciousness, so the second principle of Sat Chitananda is this double principle of Chit Shakti, and the third one is Ananda. So these are the threefold worlds of truth, consciousness, and bliss, the three highest worlds of the triune Satchitananda. And the seven immortal earths refer to the earth principle that exists on all the seven planes of existence, from the subtle physical to the world of truth. Our earth is a final condensation of these planes, all of them compressed, kaleidoscoped, as they descend and crystallize for the sake of the play. And then he says, we'll write in a little more detail with relevant passages later. Mm-hmm. So we'll wait for that.
What is Loka?
Loka means world.
World?
World. Or a place. He hasn't named the seven planes. But if we remember those planes that the mother has expressed, we would be able to identify, I think we'd be able to identify these seven earths as well as the triple heaven, which corresponds exactly to what is written here. So we can start reading on page 673 at line 88. Around her lived the children of God's day.
On a brink.
Okay, you think we stopped at whispering into lakes of liquid peace? All right. On a brink held of senseless ecstasy. Patty, would you start?
On a brink held of senseless ecstasy and guarding an eternal poise of thought, sat sculptured souls dreaming by rivers of sound in changeless attitudes of marble bliss. Around her lived the children of God's day in an unspeakable felicity. A happiness never lost, the immortal's ease, a glad eternity's blissful multitude. Around, the deathless nations moved and spoke, souls of a luminous celestial joy, faces of stark beauty, limbs of the molded ray, in cities cut like gems of conscious stone, and wonderful pastures, and on gleaming coasts, bright forms were seen. Eternity's luminous tribes.
Thank you. So thinking of these seven immortal earths, at the bottom of page 672, the poet says, the lowest of these earths was still a heaven. That, I suppose, would be the realm, the kingdom of subtle matter. And he said that lowest of these earths was translating into the splendor of things divine the beauty and brightness of terrestrials. That is, that there were landscapes that we could describe, or that the poet describes, in terms of our earthly landscapes. He spoke of the eternal mountains and the rivers, the streams and the rivers. It was the rivers that went down whispering into lakes of liquid peace. And in what Patty just read, he describes the beings, the human-like or soul-like beings who inhabit those that heaven. Some of them are as if meditating, held on a brink, on an edge of senseless ecstasy, ecstasy beyond the reach of the senses, guarding an eternal poise thought, sat sculptured souls. They are sitting in such concentration that they are as if like statues, dreaming by these rivers of sound in changeless attitudes of marble bliss. These forms of beings in deep concentration. And Savitri sees living around her the children of God's day, this everlasting day. They are living in unspeakable felicity, a happiness that is never lost. They live in a state of ease and rest without tension or anxiety because they are immortal. There's no pressure of time. They are a blissful multitude belonging to a glad eternity. And around them, there are whole nations, the deathless nations, lived, moved, and spoke. There are countries with different nations of beings, but all of them are souls of a luminous celestial joy. Their faces are full of stark beauty. Their limbs seem to be molded out of the conscious ray of light, of eternal light. And they live in cities which are carved out of conscious stone, cut like gems of conscious stone. Or they move around in the countryside in wonderful pastures and on gleaming coasts. All these bright forms are seen, eternity's luminous tribes. These are the beings. Something to ask?
Yeah.
Yeah?
When it is said that when we leave our body,
yes,
body merges with the matter, then vital goes to the vital world, mind goes then the soul goes to the soul world.
Yes.
Does it mean that this soul world that he is referring here?
I think so. I think a little later, if I'm not wrong, or perhaps we've already had it. No, it comes a little later.
Okay.
That our forefathers are there, you know, in those heavens.
We were also there sometimes.
Perhaps that's where we have come from. Perhaps that's why we can never be satisfied with anything here on earth. Yes, Don.
If I'm not mistaken, this wonderful heaven has a terrestrial aspect to it. Yes. Where's weather? Where's the hurricane?
This is the world of everlasting day. There's nothing troubled. There's no storms or disturbances. Yeah.
By deathless nations, I wonder if he means that every nation has a soul there, or if there are only certain ones that are.
I don't know, Patty. I think he means the nations that are deathless, that is, nations of souls who are immortal beings.
You know that India is a deathless nation.
No, on earth perhaps there are also, there are, as Sri Aurobindo has told us, nations, souls. But about this question of yours, Ramnarayan, you know in book 2 we have Canto 14, which speaks about the world soul. And that speaks of a kind of heaven where our souls go and refresh themselves in internatal sleep and assimilate all their past experiences and choose what will be their next earthly life. So I think that is probably where we go. He says, until their work in cosmic time is done. There's a time when the soul has fulfilled its mission in cosmic time. Then perhaps it might go to this realm. It's only a guess. I don't know. Yes. Above her.
Rhythmic Godheads whirl the spheres, rapt mobile fixities here blindly sought by the hues erring orbits of our stars. Ecstatic voices smote at the hearing scores, each movement found a music all its own. Songs thrilled of birds upon unfading buffs, the colors of whose remains had been caught from the rainbow of imagination's wings. Immortal fragrance packed the covering breeze in grooves that seemed moon bosoms and trembling depths, the million children of the undying spring bloomed pure unnumbered stars of pure delight, nestling for shelter in their emerald sky. Fairy flower masses looked with loving eyes. A dancing chaos, an iridescent sea, eternized to heaven's ever wakeful sigh, the crowding petal row of marble tints which float across the curtain lips of dream.
Thank you. So these lines are developing this idea that there in that world, even the lowest of these earths, was a heaven translating into the splendor of things divine, the beauty and brightness of terrestrial scenes, things that we see here on earth. But the first sentence that Ramnarayan read. This is about the space, the universe around. Above Savitri, there are divine beings whirling the spheres, the heavenly bodies in space, and each of them has a particular rhythm. And he says that those spheres were rapt, mobile fixities, here blindly sought by the huge, erring orbits of our stars. This idea of the heavenly spheres, each with its own music and its own note, comes from the Greek philosopher Aristotle. He envisaged the Earth at the center of the cosmos, and that we were surrounded by a series of ever larger spheres. And these spheres had holes in them, and that what we see as stars, as planets, are the heavenly light, the light of the supreme, the eternal, shining through these holes in the spheres. And the spheres are moving, and as they move, they make music. Late thinkers thought they are being moved by angels, and the angels are singing. And from Aristotle also comes the idea that who is the prime mover of all this? Why does any of it move? And he said the prime mover is love, that all this is moving by a power of attraction, the love for the supreme. So something of that idea is suggested here, that there are these rhythming godheads were moving the spheres around. But these spheres are mobile fixities. It's one of Sri Aurobindo's paradoxical expressions. How is something that's fixed, how can it be mobile? But they must be moving on the spot, something like that. And it seems, he's suggesting, that our stars, the stars that we see from Earth, of course, they all have their orbits. They move, not in perfect circles, like Aristotle's spheres, but in ellipses, some of them with wobbles in them. No. These are the erring orbits of our stars. They are not perfect. Aristotle had the idea that everything beyond our moon is perfect. So they must move in perfect circles. But beneath the moon, the sublunary spheres are imperfect. We and the mobile stars, he saw that there are some stars that are not moving in perfect, fixed, mobile fixities. There are wandering stars. He thought they must be below the moon like we are too. It's a way of imagining the cosmos. Anybody has anything to ask about the next lines? There are birds with beautiful colored feathers. There are flowers, very fragrant flowers.
I have an impression of it's sort of a struggle, I have to say, about this unending day, because I realize it's a symbol. It is not, we're not speaking of that concept of unending day, like in our dualistic thought process of there's night and there's day, there's good and evil, there's love and hate, that, you know, that breaking down dualism. So here I feel like I'm being challenged to get beyond that duality. And so there's a part of me that goes, what do you mean ever,
everlasting day.
Everlasting day, what do you mean?
Okay. Yeah, and he even speaks of there being moonlight.
Yeah. So I get that's sort of what it feels like to me. It's like my mind, which is so dualistic,
Yes.
But the symbol now of the everlasting day is to say that we can become capable of holding that or being present to divine consciousness.
At least there is a realm like that, just as there's that realm of everlasting night without the relief of any slightest light. And there are these realms of twilight. This is now a realm of everlasting light. But he does say a little further on that these are symbol worlds. They are symbols of states of consciousness or states of being. So, yes, perhaps we, in our development, we can pass from the twilight we are in now in towards this everlasting day.
That means the souls there need not rest. They are always
alive and conscious, yes.
Conscious life seems to be, they need any rest, like a body needs rest.
And he says there's no possibility of night or mist even. It's full blaze of truth light, of truth consciousness. So we will have to develop considerably before we can live in such a state permanently. No? But we might get glimpses of it. He's giving us a glimpse.
On page 672, there's a, of all the beauty and the marvel of all times interplayed variety, eternity was the substance and the source.
Yes. Because it's not made from matter. It's not made from a plastic mist of matter. Yes.
Can I make a comment on something from a little bit back?
Yes.
When we were speaking about the God of Death and
yes.
how, and God of Death is saying, people love me, people call to me, people want me, they're asking for me to come to them. And just recently I was reading in Keats, an extract from Keats,
oh,
and
yes.
something else, and he has a...
Easeful death.
Yes, an easeful death, and it's calling to death, come and ease me, be my friend, come for me now.
Yes.
And I thought, that's interesting, because it is, it's everywhere in that human...
Come for me now while I'm in this state of bliss. Yes.
So another impression comes to me is that Sri Aurobindo is describing in words, which are symbols themselves, something that he knows. I really loved the feeling that his consciousness was, he saw this, and this is described.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. That's what he says. The poet writes what he sees. It's based on vision, and Sri Aurobindo's vision is so amazingly powerful and detailed and concrete. No? Even when it's not of a the things he's describing are not made of a plastic mist of matter. He's describing them in terms of things that we are familiar with, otherwise we couldn't imagine them. No? These birds with their plumage. We're familiar with birds that have beautiful plumage, no? But these birds, the colors of their plumage has been caught from the rainbow of imagination's wings. Colors that we haven't seen, we would only have to imagine. No? And then this lovely description of the little flowers, groves in a forest, no? Those groves themselves seem like moved bosoms and trembling depths. There are growing the million children of the undying spring. You were asking about weather, Don. It was undying spring there. They're blooming, pure, unnumbered stars of hued delight. Nestling like little birds in their nest or like children in their mother's arms, nestling for shelter in their emerald sky, the wonderful green of the leaves and the grasses. Fairy flower masses looked with laughing eyes. And there's a sea that's always in movement, a dancing chaos. An iridescent sea. Iridescent means glowing with all the colors of the rainbow. This sea is, he's coined a word here, eternized to heaven's ever wakeful sight. The crowding petal glow of marvel's tints which float across the curtained eyes of dream. Sorry, of dream, yes. So if you're closing your eyes and dreaming, you might see wonderful colors that glow like petals, the petals of living flowers, that their colors have a special quality, no? That we can't catch easily in a painting or in any other form. It's the delicacy of the texture of those petals. But he says this sea in its movement is reflecting all those wonderful colors eternally, because it's being watched by the sight of heaven. The divine being is watching its movement and enjoying all those colors. So they are there eternally. It's not just something passing, as it might pass across your eyelids in a state of dream.
It says the vowels are unfading, but I wonder if it means that, in other words, it never deteriorates, but I wonder, I think that things are not stationary. In other words, everything is not fixed here. No?
No, he speaks about this moving, no? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's only that death is not there.
Yes.
So the leaves don't dry up.
Yes. Yes.
You remember on sky, one thing, it kind of like bushing that much,
Yes, the little flowers are growing perhaps on the ground, so they don't see the blue sky. They are nestling in this emerald green which is surrounding them, the grass and the bushes and the trees, something like that. Amitoj, would you read on?
Inner harmony is filled from the sea, a great spontaneous utterance of the heights, on Titan wings of rhythmic grandeur born, poured from some deep spiritual heart of sound, streams trembling with the secrets of the gods. A spirit wandered happily in the wind, a spirit rooted in the new and stone, the voices of thought-conscious instruments along a living world of silence strayed, and from some deep, a wordless tongue of things, unfathomed, inexpressible, chantings rose, translating from a voice. Translating into a voice the unknown. A climber on the invisible stair of sound, music, not with these few and striking steps, aspired that wander upon transient strings, but changed its ever-new uncounted notes in a passion of unforeseen discovery, and kept its old unforgotten ecstasies, a growing treasure in the mystic heart.
Thank you. Perhaps if we had the subtle hearing, even now we might be able to hear coming from the universe, from the upper levels of our atmosphere, some kind of music, some kind of harmony. It seems as if that atmosphere that Savitri is in, it's full of harmonies, different kinds of harmonies. And one of them is this great, spontaneous utterance of the heights, whether it's coming from the sky or from the mountains, it's being carried on Titan wings of rhythmic grandeur born, pouring out of some deep spiritual heart of sound. And what it's conveying is strains, phrases, harmonic phrases, trembling with the secrets of the gods, hinting at wonderful secrets that are held by the gods. That's one kind of harmony coming from the heights. There's also a spirit wandering happily in the wind. The wind also makes a sound as it passes, no? And she feels a spirit brooding in the leaf and stone. There's a living presence there. And there are thought-conscious instruments, beings who are aware of thought or can think, and they have voices like us. So their voices, it's as if there's a singing in the air, but that singing is wandering, you can't tell really where it's coming from, along a living verge of silence, perhaps heard very faintly and fading away into silence. And at the same time, from some deep below, a wordless tongue of things, as if from the substance and the objects that are there, there's chantings. They are singing something also. These things that are unfathomed and inexpressible. But they give a voice, they translate into a voice the unknown, as if Savitri can hear unknown things, unknown possibilities, things not yet manifested. Their voice is being heard.
Sure.
Yes.
She says something about, I'm thinking about who's speaking here.
Yes.
Is this the poet Sri Aurobindo, or is this the man who experiences sounds?
Well, it's the poet Sri Aurobindo describing things he has experienced. And he's giving these experiences to Savitri and to us. He's giving us a hint so that we can begin to imagine these unknown things.
For me, this is a special meaning because I was in a radio station and we did radio plays with good actors from theater. And to speak consciously a word for a radio play, you have to be very conscious what you are speaking. Consciously. And then the picture, the meaning comes out. If you just speak like this, we would, so I think this conscious thing is also a quality which we have all to develop. Mm. So,
Is this a, I'm a little bit lost. This is the, he's describing the lowest of the seven earths.
Yes.
Okay.
Mentioned the highest. Now what he tries to do, I think, you should not go by the literal significance of the words, but try to end the vibration he creates using the senses. All senses are taken to a subliminal state of perception. It's so intense that he tries to say to you in music, his hearing, his eyes, his this, the thoughts. It's a sense in a thing. So if you go by literal steps, word by word, you miss the whole thing. It's
yes.
Just probing it. I think that's fine.
But in the next passage about music, he's comparing that music there with our music here.
Yeah.
And that's one of the ways he uses to give us access to things that are unknown to us. He says, with us, music is climbing, not with a few and striving steps. If we think of the notes of music, music seems to be made out of distinct notes, even though we sometimes have half tones and quarter tones and so on. So he says, here you on earth in matter with your physical hearing, they are so few. These steps that are available, and they work with effort, with striving. No? Those are the notes that are aspiring for something higher, but they are wandering on our transient strings, the strings of our harps and violins and other musical instruments. There, the music is changing with ever new, uncounted notes. There's no limit to the number of notes. No? And it's always discovering something new and unexpected in a passion of unforeseen discovery. But at the same time, it's keeping the memory of everything that it has already experienced, kept its old, unforgotten ecstasies, a growing treasure in the mystic heart.
Regarding what he said, it's good to have overall picture as well as fine human senses, fineness of it. So we have to go at every word also. Plus individual word and what he's trying to say in detail.
What we do here is that we try to get what we can out of the words. Then it's up to everybody to go home and work with these passages and go into them as deep as you possibly can. I've said this before, but it's maybe a good moment to say it again, that in India the traditional method of learning a mantra had four steps. The first one was to learn the sound, the rhythm and the sound of the words, and then the literal meaning, the meaning, surface meaning of the words, the way their particular significances of each one, the way they're connected to each other, the suggestions that they contain. This was the next step. And this could be taught. But then the one who was given the mantra was supposed to repeat it mentally until he got some sense of understanding of the meaning. And then he was supposed to focus on that sound, suggestions, meaning, until all that went away and he got a direct experience of the seeing, the knowledge of the Rishi who had received this mantra, expressed it in words. So these two last stages are things that we can only do on our own. We can't do that really here in the class. Yes, Sudha. Yes, it's interesting here in this context, the word instruments has a double meaning. No? We can think about the instruments on which music is played, and we can think about ourselves or other beings being instruments of a higher consciousness through thought. So both those suggestions are in this line. No? Yeah, there are voices of thought conscious instruments. I think it can be connected to mantras, yes. But it also connects with what Margaret was saying. They say that of all the musical instruments, the most expressive one is the human voice. That means the instrument can be conscious of at least some aspects of what it is being expressed. And we hear this so marvelously in Mother's recitations of these lines. She reads from such a high consciousness, with such a concentration. There's so much in the sound of her voice. You know?
Voice is very clear, very slow, and I learn much more fast. I thank you really when Kiribai teach. Automatically, you live everywhere, but you also. You put another level. That's all. And it's very great for me, it's true. It's a level.
Who's responsible for this music?
Sorry, he's hiding.
So if there's something about my voice or my expression which is helpful, then I'm very glad. So let's go on. Line 135. Stefanie.
Yes. A consciousness that yearns through heavenly cry of unexplored attraction and desire. It found and searched again the unsatisfied deeps, hunting as if in some deep secret heart to find some lost or missed felicity. In those far-lapsing symphonies she could hear, breaking through enchantments of the ravished sense, the lyric voyage of a divine soul, mid spume and laughter tempting with its brow, the charm of innocent Circean eyes, adventures without measure, beautiful in lands where siren wonder signs its lures, from rhythmic rocks in never forming seas.
Thank you. This continues about music. Mm-hmm. This is about music.
Dangerous one. I mean, you refer to
the siren wonder, yeah. Yes.
What are rhythmic rocks?
Yeah, first of all, we have to get the allusion. But first of all, we should look at the first sentence. This music there is a consciousness. In addition to everything else, it's a consciousness that's yearning through every cry of unexplored attraction and desire. So the music finds unsatisfied deeps of feeling, of knowledge, of emotion. No? It finds something and then it searches again, as if in some deep secret heart it's always searching to see whether it can't find some felicity, some delight that's been lost or been missed, always to find more and more and more delight. So as Savitri listens to that music and those immortal harmonies, they are like symphonies. In those far-lapsing symphonies, she can hear them faintly in the distance. No? What does it convey to her? And to convey what it conveys to her, Sri Aurobindo uses an allusion. He alludes to the ancient Greek epic, the Odyssey, which tells about the return of Odysseus and his companions from the Trojan War. And they have a very long journey because the god of the sea, Poseidon, is angry with Ulysses, with Odysseus. But here Sri Aurobindo refers to two adventures that they have on their way. One of them is visiting the island of the enchantress Circe. And in, of course, the quality of this adventure as described in the ancient Greek epic and the quality that Sri Aurobindo gives it here in the allusion is so different, so contrasting. It's really the difference between earth and heaven. There, Odysseus and his companions are having a very difficult and dangerous time. No? And finally, they reach this delightful island, and seems to be deserted, but there's music in the air. And anyway, they need water and food. So he sends off a couple of scouts onto the island to find out whether there's anything useful there. They don't come back. So then he sends a few more. They don't come back. And in the end, he has to go himself. And in the center of the island, he finds a lovely grove with a table laid out with all kinds of delicious food and drink, and nobody around. But he realizes there's a lot of pigs about. These are his companions. They've eaten the food, they've drunk the drink, and they've been turned into pigs, because that's what Circe does to you. She turns you into an animal. And then he has to find a way to get them back, which he does. They stay there then for some time. And when finally they are leaving, Circe warns them. She can tell them which is the way to go to reach their home. But she warns them that on the way they will have to be very careful, because they'll have to pass these special rocks. On the rocks there are beautiful girls or mermaids or something like that singing. And that singing is so beautiful, so irresistible, that all the sailors who pass that way, they crash their ships on the rocks and they're drowned. So these rocks and these sirens, they're really very dangerous. And in the story, Odysseus himself is determined to hear this music, but he doesn't want them to get wrecked. So he makes his sailors plug their ears with wax. All of them have to plug their ears so that they don't hear anything. And they have to tie him to the mast so that he can't jump into the sea and fly, swim off to the rocks. And in this way, they manage to get past. He has the experience of the sirens, and they go safely on their way, and eventually they reach home. But Sri Aurobindo has made something different out of this illusion, or this adventure. What she hears in the music is the lyric voyage of a divine soul, as if Ulysses is a symbol of the soul, no? And this is our innocent adventures. That soul is having a wonderful experience, sailing, tempting with its prow, mid spume and laughter. It's a joyful journey. And they are trying out, the divine soul is trying out, tempting the charm of innocent Circean isles, islands full of magic, but it's not dangerous and terrible. No? These are adventures without danger, beautiful, in lands where the siren wonder. This is marvel. It is the ecstasy of marvel that sings its lures, its attraction, from rhythmic rock in ever-foaming seas. This is a kind of eternal archetype of the adventure of the soul. The soul on a level where it can enjoy all these adventures without danger.
Siren is also a musical instrument.
A siren usually is that loud sound that the Anglo-French factory in Pondy makes in the mornings. That's a siren. And the other kind of siren is the air raid warning siren. No? But here it refers particularly to these magical, beautiful beings who are dangerous.
They are birds, women.
Half birds.
Half women, half birds.
Birds, yes.
And in the Middle Age, it was changed in a mermaid, half women. But originally in the Greek period, they were half birds. Women, superior power. And when you hear the sound, it was paralyzing. You got totally paralyzed by it and
attracted by it.
You just hear there. That's why we bound ourselves.
They were called sirens.
Huh?
They were sirens.
These beings are called sirens, yes. And the thing is, it's so attractive. So Medananda, who knew a lot about ancient Greek mythology, perhaps he read this line in Savitri, and then he said, oh, now I've got it. What is that irresistible attraction? What is that attraction that you can't resist? It's the call of eternal bliss. It's actually what we are all dashing ourselves against the rocks of life in search of. But here he's put it into such glorious poetry. What term are we at? Yes.
This from rhythmic rocks in the ever falling seas. I remember somebody visited me a music album called Soundscape.
Yes.
There is one called Mountain, one called Ocean. There is a sound of water splashing against the rock. Is that what he is referring to?
I think he's referring to the total experience. What is it like to sail on a beautiful, choppy sea with the wind driving you along, and you come to some very beautiful looking rocks, and there are some beautiful looking beings, very attractive beings, singing such a beautiful sound.
So the form is created by the waves hitting the rocks?
It's as it hits the boat, the foam and the spume, no? As you move along fast in a boat, there'll be foam coming up at the front. That's called spume. And he mentions the prow. The prow is the sharp front pointing part of the ship, of a boat. And you must imagine those old boats, no? They had a sail, so when there was a wind they could sail, but otherwise they had to row.
In the definition, which is in here, there's one sentence which is, I think, interesting.
Yeah.
The adjectival use here, that is just described here, what the siren is, the adjectival use here suggests the sweet allurement of the siren song and not its malevolence.
Yes, he specifically says it's without danger.
Yes.
Here in our world, or in the ancient Greek world, all this is very dangerous. These are painful, terrible adventures that the soul has to go through before it can reach its home. But now, here in this world of everlasting day, one can have all the delight of those adventures without the danger. On this level, in the everlasting day, it suggests the possibility, the music that she hears suggests the possibility of these adventures being innocent. Yes. But here, in our world, we have different suggestions. No? Be careful.
You said that these words are condensed in our world. They are present.
To the extent that they're states of consciousness, yes. Yes, you are right, of course. That's what Alok Pandey says, no? That the seven immortal earths, yes, yes. But now when she's in this world, she's not in our material world. She still has a connection with it, but what she's experiencing is something that we can't directly experience here. I think. Only by going into our subtle bodies onto other planes we can have this experience.
Or maybe the future of our world.
Sorry?
Maybe the future of our world.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
And when we get a glimpse of the infinite enjoyments that lie waiting for us in the tracts which our earthly evolution has not yet reached. If we would get that glimpse, look, he's doing his best to give us the glimpse. He said, men would leave all and go for that. So that's what he would like us to do, to think that reaching these states and realizing these possibilities on earth is the only really worthwhile thing to do.
So he also said, when men would know what the beauty is.
Yeah.
Would run only after it.
Yes. We would leave it all and follow after it. Sri Aurobindo concentrated on word painting. Yes. These are different possibilities, no? Mother painted, mother made music. Sri Aurobindo was. So let's go a little bit further. I think we'll go to the next draw. Bessie, will you read? It's line in the harmony of an original sight. Yeah, you got it?
Yeah. In the harmony of an original sight, delivered from our limiting way of thought and the reluctance of our blind hearts, embrace the Godhead in whatever. Invaded by beauty's universal level, her beauty's fiber switch out like vintage, and claimed deep union with its outer self, and on the heart's
subtleties.
Core.
Oh, sorry.
Made pure to seize all turns. Heaven's subtleties. Unvarying source, more vivid raptures than earth's life can bear. What would be suffering here was fiery bliss, all here that passionate hint and mystic shape, divine by the inner prophet who perceives. The spirit of delight in sensuous things turned to more sweetness than can now be dreamed.
Thank you. So Savitri has been delivered from our limiting ray of thought so that she can see things with this harmony of an original sight, a sight beyond thought, not limited by thought. And she's also delivered from the reluctance of our blinded hearts in our present state of ignorance. We are reluctant to embrace the Godhead in whatever disguise he comes. We think that the divine must be like this or like that. We are not able to see him when he, or experience him when he comes like a scorpion and stings our foot in the night. We are not able to see him in disaster and catastrophe. But she is delivered from that reluctance of our blinded hearts to embrace the Godhead in whatever guise, whatever appearance it presents itself. So she can see all nature marvelous without fault. And this means that she's invaded by beauty's universal revel. She's able to see the play of beauty in throughout the universe. And so the fiber, the very substance of her being reaches out vibrating and claimed deep union with its outer selves, with all the things that normally seem to be outside our body. Here again Sri Aurobindo speaks of the heart as a musical instrument on which chords can be played. So on the heart's chords, made pure to seize all tones, can vibrate to all the different unending number of notes. Heaven's subtleties of touch, playing on those heart strings, went on unwearying. It doesn't get tired of forcing on Savitri's heart more vivid raptures than Earth's life can bear. We wouldn't be able to endure the intensities of those delights. There, in her state, what would be suffering here was fiery bliss, an intense, passionate delight. And everything that here in our world delights us, just as passionate hints and mystic shades that get somehow divined, sensed by the inner prophet within us who perceives the spirit of delight in things that we experience through our senses. Those kind of hints and shades turned to more sweetness that can now be dreamed. We can't even begin to imagine the subtleties of those touches, those feelings and sensations. We'll continue with this next time. We can hear Mother reading some lines from this canto.
Eternal mountain sleep on a gleaming lake, whose lines were gleamed as on safari, and tis the morning's haven lost or snow, climbed like fired temple stairs, and from their head, all topless meditation, heard below. The approach of a bloom will bring multitudes, and listen to the great arising voice of the white tribal hymn of timeless seas. In cities cut like gems of conscious stone, and wonderful pastures, and unmeaning coasts, bright forms were seen. Eternity's luminous tide, about her, between Godhead's world, the sphere, wrapped mobile fixity, here blindly sought by the huge erring orbits of our stars. Immortal harmony filled her listening ear. A great spontaneous utterance of the heights
Thanks to Sherbindor.